So today we will consider briefly the concept of Wigner's eight cell, the topic we didn't have time to consider yesterday. Then we will introduce the concept of reciprocal lattice and the first Brillouin zone, the abbreviation RRL and 1BZ. And we will consider the famous Bloch's theorem that classifies the states when electron or particle moves in a periodic potential, and talk about the concept of quasi-momentum. So on the previous lecture, we introduced the concepts of primitive vectors and the primitive or unit cell. So this is the square lattice, and we showed that we could introduce primitive vectors in different ways, and these ways resulted in different primitive cells. So we can choose A1 and A2 and the unit cell having this form, and we can choose A1 and A2 parallel to the axis, and this will result in the unit cell having this form. There is one more important concept related to the Brillouin lattices. And of course, this concept is not limited to the case of square lattice. Simply, it is also much more convenient to illustrate this concept when we have the square lattice. So this concept is the Wigner-Zeitz cell. It is named after famous physicist Eugene Wigner and famous material scientist Frederick Zeitz. Wigner-Zeitz cell. So I will write down the definition because it is very important. So a Wigner-Zeitz cell is a primitive unit cell that has the symmetry of the Brillouin lattice and is constructed by taking a point on the lattice and associating with it all of the space, all of the space that is closest to this particular point. So what does this definition combined with prescription how to build the Wigner-Zeitz cell means? Let's look at our square lattice and take, for example, this point. Well, first of all, we must have that Wigner-Zeitz cell has the form of a primitive unit cell that coincides with the symmetry of the square lattice. If we look at this primitive cell, does it coincide with the symmetry of the square lattice? The answer is no. No. And if we look at this primitive cell, then we can say that it coincides with the symmetry of the square lattice. Yes?
Why did the derived one doesn't?
Well, because this unit cell has the same elements of the symmetry as the square lattice, and this does not. For example, if you rotate square lattice by 90 degrees, then the square lattice turns into itself, right? So if you rotate this by 90 degrees, then this unit cell will turn into itself, right? And if you rotate this thing by 90 degrees, what are you going to have?
Well,
So this is the point. Yes, this primitive cell has the same symmetry as the square lattice. But let's follow our prescription. Let's take, for example, this point and try to find the space around this point that is closer to this point than to any other of the neighboring point. The prescription is quite remarkable and quite rigorous. We start from this point and draw simple lines, not vectors, but lines to all nearest neighbors. So we have four nearest neighbors. And then draw the other set of lines that cuts each of these four lines in half. So this space is called the Wigner-Zeitz cell. So it is possible to show by some kind of geometrical consideration that everything that lies inside is closer to this point rather to any other points on the lattice. So this is our Wigner-Zeitz cell. This prescription works for all other forms of Bravais lattices. So it is very general, right? Yeah.
So for d dimensions, you would choose like 2D nearest
neighbor. For three dimensions, yeah, for three dimensions, you will count all the nearest neighbors, then draw the lines.
But you choose like just the nearest six.
Yeah, you will have, yes, six nearest neighbors. You draw all the lines, but in this case you have to draw the planes that cut all those lines in half. So of course it is much simpler to illustrate this in two dimensions. For example, you can choose triangular lattice that has six nearest neighbors, so each point has six nearest neighbors. And you could also do the same thing and see that your Wigner-Zeitz cell is apparently a hexagon.
But how do you know how many nearest neighbors
you choose? All of the nearest neighbors.
All of the points in space?
Yeah, all of the points in space.
Like your
one, two, three, four. Because this is not the nearest neighbor. This is next to nearest neighbor.
What he's getting at is if you have a rectangular lattice, mm-hmm. say, that's stretched out in this direction, then the nearest neighbors are just going to be the two points at the top and the bottom.
You
right?
Don't pick the nearest neighbors. You draw lines to every point in space, and then you draw bisecting lines, and then the enclosed thing is your...
Yeah, so if you have a rectangular lattice, then your Wigner-Zeitz cell will also be a rectangle. It will also have a rectangular form. So
the word nearest neighbor
okay.
are a little bit ambiguous.
Okay, a little bit ambiguous. Well, for the cases of square and triangular lattices, this is pretty much clear. But for a rectangular lattice, yeah, you're right, a bit ambiguous here, right?
Like you wouldn't actually, in a general situation, draw lines to all points in space and write five bisecting lines, and mm-hmm. then the space enclosed by the closest, like the smallest space enclosed is the Wigner-Zeitz cell. So like that.
Yeah, I mean, I can see how
you
just get the same thing there.
Okay, so can I move forward? So, in condensed matter courses, we will be dealing only with the square lattices and possibly with triangular ones, but not more complicated. So it's much more convenient to illustrate those concepts if we have the simplest possible lattice in two-dimensional space. Right. So now we will talk about the reciprocal lattice. and the first brilliant zone. Again, everything will be illustrated on the examples of hypercubic lattices, basically cubic lattice in three dimensions and square lattice in two dimensions. Reciprocal lattice and first brilliant zone. Again, the definition, vectors k, and it is important that the vectors of reciprocal lattice, the general ones, are often in all textbooks labeled by large letters, k, q, and so forth. K constitute the reciprocal lattice vectors if for any vector r belonging to the original Bravais lattice they satisfy the following condition: e in power I large k dot large r, we have the scalar product, is equal to 1. So is equal to 1. So since we're talking about the lattice, then we can say that, say, in d dimensions, any k can be represented as the sum of I from 1 to d k I times b I. So very similar to what we had for r belonging to the Bravais lattice. Again, the k i's are integers. And bi's are linearly independent. So bi's form the basis of the reciprocal lattice. So they are linearly independent and act as primitive vectors. Primitive vectors in reciprocal lattice. Yeah, so since we're talking about the lattice, then any vector can be represented in this form as a linear combination of some integers times the primitive vectors. The primitive vectors of reciprocal lattice are called the bi's. The question is, how can we construct those primitive vectors, bi's, if we know the form of our Bravais lattice? And the prescription is the following. And is based on a very simple theorem that if bi vector dot aj equal to 2 pi delta ij, where ai are the primitive vectors of the Bravais lattice. So we have r equal to sum. A bit down. R is equal to sum of I between 1 and d, and I ai, and k is equal to sum between 1 and d of k small I bi. So if this condition holds, then it is easy to see that this equation satisfies automatically. Why? Because k large dot r is equal to 2 pi sum from over I from 1 to d a I sorry k I and I, and this is an integer number. So if we substitute 2 pi times integer number into this equation, we automatically get 1. So very often in the textbook, the definition of the primitive vectors for the reciprocal lattice starts from this equation. And people simply solve this equation knowing the primitive vectors of the Bravais lattice. The solution, of course, depends on dimensionality, and it depends on the form of the Bravais lattice. So to illustrate, let's consider several cases of different dimensionality. So in 1D, what do we have in 1D? So in 1D, we have just simply chain of sides, say, located along x direction. And the lattice spacing is simply A. Then what will be the primitive vector of reciprocal lattice? It will be given by B equal to 2 pi A times unit vector in x direction. And the reciprocal lattice will be also a chain only with this period, 2 pi over A. So this is quite simple. So in three dimensions, things are more complicated. So we have just the simple cubic lattice. And what we need to know what the volume of the primitive cell of the Bravais lattice is. So in three dimensions, if A1, A2, A3 are primitive vectors, then V is the volume of the unit or primitive cell is given by A1 dot the vector that is formed as the vector product of the remaining two vectors, A2 cross A3. So this is the volume of the primitive cell. Of Bravais lattice in 3D. So, and this is just a standard textbook exercise that is essentially given on many introductory courses on solid state physics, just to check that V1 is equal to 2 pi over V times the vector product A2, A3. B2 is equal to 2 pi over V times the vector product A3, A1. And B3 is equal to 2 pi over V times the vector product, as you can see, A1 and A2. So it's quite difficult to draw everything in the three dimensions, so I will just state the result. So you can just check that this definition holds. And finally, in 2D. In 2D, things are simpler and can be drawn. So suppose we have our Bravais lattice, square Bravais lattice. And we have the primitive vectors A1 and A2. And let's assume that we have that axis that points at us out of the blackboard, point at us. So this will be that axis. Then the volume of the primitive cell of the Bravais lattice is given by the following formula, V equal to absolute value of A1 cross A2. And if Z is the unit vector in Z direction and pointing at S, then we have that B1 equal to 2 pi over V, A2 vector product with Z. And B2 equal to 2 pi over V times Z times the vector product of Z with A1. So we can draw in this case the reciprocal lattice as well. And we can draw this as follows. So here's the reciprocal lattice that it also has the square form. And we have B2 pointing in this direction and B1 pointing in this direction. So this is just the reciprocal lattice in two dimensions. Any question? Yeah.
Is it more like intuitive to think of the bees as a one form?
To think of bees?
As like a one form, dual to the vector day.
Well, bees they form the set of vectors that are linear independent. I can say. They're just linear independent vectors that play the same role as the linear independent primitive vectors for the original Bravais lattice, not the inverse one. One form. Actually, I don't know. So you are meaning something from differential geometry. I don't know actually. So we can think of this set as one form, yeah.
Guess that just by that definition, take up the two pi.
So I believe it is easier to solve the system of linear equations directly without just additional complications. If we know all the primitive vectors, just solve it directly, construct the system of linear equations and determine all the components of B1 and B2. So simply here I stated the result that is intuitively quite simple. Okay. So, and finally, what is the first Brillouin zone? So, Wigner, Zeitz, cell of a reciprocal lattice is called first Brillouin zone. Zone that is often labeled N1BZ. The first Brillouin zone is very important because if you translate this area along all the primitive vectors, you recover the whole reciprocal lattice. This is the same as you translate either primitive cell depicted there or Wigner-Zeitz cell for the Bravais lattice along the primitive vectors. So you recover the whole Bravais lattice. So we can take any point from inside of the Brillouin zone, add any reciprocal lattice vector, and get another point belonging to the same reciprocal lattice. So again, I will give two examples how the first Brillouin zone looks like in one dimension, in two dimensions. So in 1D, So we have the reciprocal lattice with a period 2 pi over a, and what we do to construct this zone. So suppose we start from 0. This point is 0. So this point is minus 2 pi over a. This point is 2 pi over a. We draw the lines, then cut them in halves. And this space will be our first brilliant zone in one dimension. So in one dimension, we have k So if we label this axis as k, then k varies from minus pi over a to pi over a. So this is just in momentum space. So this is our first brilliant zone. So we can do the same in two dimensions in a completely similar way how we drew the Wigner Z cell for the original Bravais lattice. So if this is the reciprocal lattice, so we take, for example, this space and assume that this is origin, then again, the first brilliant zone will be this square, Wigner Z cell of the reciprocal lattice. So in this case, if this is ky and this is kx, we have that both kx and ky vary from minus pi over a to pi over a. So it's already a more difficult exercise, for example, to draw the first brilliant zone for triangular lattice in two dimensions and see in which regions kx and ky should lie. So, but here things are very, very, very simple. So we are done with a very, very preliminary tour over the basic concept of the lattices. And I illustrated all those concepts on the simplest possible cases of hypercubic lattices in different dimensions. So we will go to our next topic, motion and periodic potential, if you don't have any questions.
I actually have one question. Yeah. So I don't understand why like the point zero is in the reciprocal lattice.
We just assumed. We just assumed that origin, point kx and ky equal to zero, is just for our convenience, lies necessarily within the first brilliant zone. Okay. This is just an assumption. Yeah.
I know it satisfies that like mathematically, but if you think about like what the reciprocal lattice is, it's the Fourier transform of the real lattice.
Mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
So saying like having the zero point in there is saying that that the lattice is symmetric under continuous transformations, which it's not, right? Like under continuous translation.
Well, it is symmetric under translation with the fixed period.
It's the opposite. Never mind. It has
uh-huh.
a period of.
It has the period. Yeah. It has, of course, the translation invariance, okay. But with very well defined period.
No, I understand.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
So before we move forward with the Bloch theorem, let's consider some useful preliminary relations that we will need while proving this theorem. So just the mini paragraph is called Some Useful Relations. And these relations are so concerned with Fourier transforms. So suppose that the first relation will be as follows. So let Q is the momentum for a particle in a box in our famous L by L by L box. Just let's for simplicity consider three-dimensional case. So in our L by L by L box, and Q is equal to 2 pi over L times the set of integers Lx, Ly, Lz. Then we have our first relation that when we integrate over the whole volume, and I denote this as dr, dr, actually it's better to denote by d3i since we're considering three-dimensional case, of e in power I q minus q prime dot r, and this will be equal to L cubed delta q comma q prime. So since in this case we still consider q being discrete, we have here the discrete delta function. So that this is a very simple relation, that follows. So if we say consider, so this we have a scalar product and have the sum of terms under the sign of exponents, so this total exponent factorizes, and so we can say that this relation follows from, say, the fact that if we integrate on only x direction, and we have e in power qx minus qx prime x, then this is equal to this is just equal. If qx is not equal to qx prime, then we have that this is 1 over I qx minus qx prime times e in power I qx minus qx prime L minus 1. And this is 0 because qx is not equal to qx prime, and what stands here is necessarily 1. So this is just 0, and if qx is equal to x prime, then this is just L. So 0 if qx not equal to qx prime, and L if qx equal to qx prime. So doing the similar considerations regarding all other direction, we recover this result. So I hope there are no questions about this.
You're integrating over the volume of the box?
Yeah, yes, over the volume of the box. Very good. Over the volume of the box. Of the box, right. So Q is the momentum for a particle in the box. So as a consequence of this relation, one can consider some function, psi, also a function of coordinates inside the box, but obeying our famous periodic boundary conditions. So if psi of r satisfies periodic boundary conditions, then we, so periodic boundary conditions is as we defined in the box. Yeah, any questions?
No.
Okay, yeah. If psi being a function of R satisfies periodic boundary conditions inside the box, then we can introduce the Fourier transform. Psi of R equal to sum over all Qs, over all momentum Qs we mentioned above, of Fourier components psi functions of Q times E in power I Q R, Q dot R. This is the direct Fourier transform and inverse Fourier transform, psi of Q equal to 1 over V, integrating D3R over the volume of the box, psi of R, E in power minus I Q R. Due to the conditions written above, we can check that these transformations are consistent with each other. So let's label them with the double stars. Very, very good. These transformations will be necessary when we will prove in several minutes the Bloch's theorem. But that's not all. That's not all. Because we're going to consider the potential that is periodic in space with the period of the primitive vectors of the Bravais lattice, then we can introduce another Fourier transform. So if U of R satisfies U of R small plus R large equal to U of R small with R large belonging to the Bravais lattice, then we can introduce Fourier transform, and the Fourier transform will be over the vectors of reciprocal lattice. So then we can write that U of R equal to sum over all vectors of reciprocal lattice K, U functions of large K, E I large K dot R. So because of the condition that introduces the reciprocal lattice vector, so if you add R large to R small, then this exponent won't change because E in power I K large dot R large is equal to 1. And inverse Fourier transform. And U of K large equal to 1 over V integral D3R U of R E in power minus I K large dot R small. But the integral here is taken over the volume of the primitive cell. Primitive cell. So there is some similarity in this set of transformation. We will call them as three stars, just for our references. And this set of transformations. But here, when we talk about the inverse Fourier transform, we integrate over the volume of the box. And here, we integrate over the volume of the primitive cell. And as a prefactor, we have a 1 over the volume of the primitive cell. So these are just auxiliary transformations that we will use when we start proving our Bloch's theorem. So now we are ready to formulate the Bloch's theorem and to prove it. And the remaining time of the lecture will be devoted exactly to that. Bloch's theorem. So this theorem was first proven by the famous Swiss physicist Felix Bloch in 1928, and the paper he published in the journal Zeitschrift für Physik is considered a classical paper. Unfortunately, I don't understand German. I cannot read it. So albeit I tried. I tried at least to look at the formulas. This is the key theorem that opened the whole door towards the studies of solid-state physics, motions of electrons in real solids, a motion that necessarily occurs in the presence of periodic potential. Let me just write down the formulation of the theorem itself. So, theorem. The eigenfunctions of Hamiltonian H, written this way, minus H bar squared divided by 2m Nabla squared plus U of R with U of R satisfying U of R plus large R equal to U of small r. So large R belonging to the Bravais lattice can be chosen in the form. In the form, say K small, I will in a moment say what K small is, and some index n as a function of r equal to e in power I k dot r u that have also indices small k, then n r with u k n r small plus r large equal to u k n, the function of r small, can be chosen in this form. So it's some kind of a phase factor in the form of the running wave times some periodic function that has the period equal to the vector belonging to the Bravais lattice. So it is periodic with any with the period equal to r. So k small belongs to the first Brillouin zone and is called quasi-momentum, or quasi-momentum. And N is called band index. So we will see. So this is the formulation of the theorem. We will see that the eigenvalues will be also the functions of quasi-momentum k, and will also have band index equal to n. N is integer. Yeah. The most yes.
So I'm not sure what you mean when you say k belongs to the first Brillouin zone.
Small k. Yeah.
Small k.
Yeah.
So do you take the small, the first brilliant zone around the zero vector?
Around any vector. Around any point.
Around any point.
Yeah, around any point, because everything, all eigenfunctions and eigenvectors, eigenvalues will be periodic with the period of reciprocal lattice vector. So that they will be. So everything will translate into itself if shifted by any reciprocal lattice vector.
Okay, but if you shift the first brilliant zone by the lattice vectors, the vectors of the reciprocal lattice.
Well, we assume that the first brilliant zone is defined somewhere in space, in the reciprocal space.
Okay, but
in momentum space,
how
yes.
How do you define somewhere?
Like, as I shown,
you choose the point where this.
It's arbitrary. It's the arbitrary point. So let's assume, better said, let's imagine the reciprocal lattice, right? Choose any point. And construct the first brilliant zone around this point. All physics will be determined by K belonging to this first brilliant zone around one particular point.
But if that choice is arbitrary, then that K can be any vector, can be arbitrary, right?
This K?
Yeah.
Well, it must belong to the first brilliant zone. It cannot stretch past the first brilliant zone. That,
but
that's very important.
The brilliant zone can be anywhere, so
it's like an equivalent plan.
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter. You are thinking about a volume in the reciprocal space, and translated brilliant zones are just equivalent.
Yeah.
Just
imagine that you have the first brilliant zone somewhere in a reciprocal in momentum space, and you have the reciprocal lattice. And assume that K varies within the boundaries of this first brilliant zone. Because if you choose any other point in space, then you can always go back. I will illustrate this tomorrow when I talk about the case of weak periodic potential. So even if we construct something in the whole space, we must necessarily shift back. So that everything belongs to the first brilliant zone. So, okay, now let me devote the remaining time to the proof of this theorem. It's not very complicated. It's not very, very complicated, in fact. But it's important because it allows us to understand many important concepts. The main of which is that in the presence of periodic potential, everything is determined not by ordinary momentum, but by quasi-momentum lying in the first brilliant zone. So what we are going to do, let's use our relations and write. So we still consider that our system in a very large L by L by L box. And inside this box, we have, some lattice of ions that provides periodic potential. Just imagine this. Then we can write down the Fourier transform, psi of r equal to sum over q, psi of q times e I q r, right? So Q is the momentum as written above, so for a particle in the whole box. Then U of R, we use our third relations and Fourier expand over reciprocal lattice K. U of large K, what's very important, E in power I, large K, R.
What's the relation of U to the box right now? Like U is a periodic potential in the box?
U is a periodic potential in the box, exactly. In the box, yeah. Yeah, that's important. Q is the momentum for the particle in the box that is discrete and in the thermodynamic limit continuous. And U of R reflects the periodic potential inside the box. So we then write that minus h bar squared over 2m del nabla squared psi of r is equal to sum over q h bar squared over 2m times q squared psi of q e in power I q r, right? And u of r times psi of r equal to sum. And here I will do the following. Sum over q coming from the Fourier transform of psi of r. And sum, I will label this as k large prime, simply for convenience. Psi of q u of k prime, k large prime, e in power I k large prime plus q r. So, and what we can do here, we can simply shift, make a shift, introducing, substituting q by q minus k large prime, and get that this is sum over k large prime q u of k large prime psi of q minus k large prime e in power I q r. So substituting all those relations in our Schrödinger equation, we get, so as a consequence, we get the following Schrödinger equation. Sum over all q e in power I q r, and we have here the large curly bracket. H bar squared q squared divided by 2m minus e psi of q plus sum over k large prime u of k large prime psi q minus k large prime. And this is equal to zero. Very good. So because all Fourier components in this expression are independent, then we must require that this curly bracket turns into zero. So, and let's do one last shift. Do one last shift and see what we have arrived to. So just in this equation that is presented in the curly brackets, we set simply q equal to k small minus k large, with k belonging to the first Brillouin zone. So as I mentioned, the first Brillouin zone is defined somewhere in space around some point, and we pretend that we fixed all k's lying within the boundaries of the first Brillouin zone. All other vectors can be obtained by shifting k with all possible reciprocal lattice vectors. Set and relabel. prime by k prime minus simply k. Well, any sum or difference of two reciprocal lattice vectors will be obviously also some kind of reciprocal lattice vector, right? So we can always do this transformation. And as a result, we get the following equation. H bar squared divided by 2m, k small belonging to the first Brillouin zone, minus k large, minus E psi of k small minus k large plus
the k minus k squared,
right? Oh, thank you very much, squared, yeah, thank you very much. Plus sum over k large prime U of k large prime minus k psi of k minus k small minus k large prime equal to zero. So let's see what's this. Let's call it with the very big star. So what's this? This is the system of equation. Why is this the system of equation? Because we have k belonging to the first Brillouin zone, and we have all possible reciprocal lattice vectors that shift the points away from the first Brillouin zone or into the first Brillouin zone. So we have infinite number of large k's, and small fixed k belonging to the first Brillouin zone. And this equation, strictly speaking for the arbitrary form of the potential, represents the infinite system of linear equations that presumably, of course, allows us to determine all components psi of small k minus k large and the corresponding eigen energies. So this system of equations is infinite, and we can only hope that for realistic forms of periodic potentials, we can solve it. But let's pretend that we can. And we can say that as a result of solving this star, we determine psi of simple small k belonging to the first Brillouin zone, then psi, say, k small minus k large prime, then psi of small minus k large double prime, and so forth. We hope that we have psi as a function of small k, where k belongs to the Brillouin zone, and all other components that are shifted away from Brillouin zone, first Brillouin zone, by all possible reciprocal lattice vectors. So suppose that as a result of solving this infinite, this system of infinite number of equations, we have all this set of all possible components that are enumerated like this. So, and if we have their solution, so if we have the solution, if psi, say, of k k minus, if I would say if all are known, then returning to our formula that gives us psi of r there, we will have psi of r equal to I in power k small r times sum over all reciprocal lattice vectors psi of k small minus k large e in power minus I k large dot r. So what we did, in fact, we substituted the sum over all q's by one second only. So those functions psi of r will have the index k, because we fix k within the Brillouin zone and assume that this k is translated by all possible reciprocal lattice vectors. So the general, of course, expansion of psi of r, it will further contain the linear combination of psi k of r with different values of small k lying within the Brillouin zone. But this psi having index small k, a function of r, has further expansion with respect to these components that are known as a result of this solution, as a result of the solution of this system of equations, because we fixed small k. And these will be our eigenfunctions. What we're left to do, we're left to simply to label this as u of k as a function of r. So because it contains the expansion with respect to reciprocal lattice vectors, then this construction is periodic with any r belonging to the original Bravais lattice. Yes, I will maybe make a pause here, making sure that you understand this. So these are the eigenfunctions of the Schrödinger equations in the form of periodic potential. And we have proven that they have this form. So what we, in fact, did, we say that we have the whole sequence of q's, and this whole sequence of q's can be broken into groups belonging that are labeled by the vector small k from the first Brillouin zone and distinguished by shifts by all possible reciprocal lattice vectors. The further question you, of course, now must ask, where does index n come from? Where does n come from? And the answer is very, very, very simple. So let's take this construction, e in power I k r times u k as a function of r, with u being periodic, and act with Hamiltonian h on this function. So we have h acting on u k r, e in power I k r, And when we do the algebra, we will have h bar squared divided by 2m, and here we have 1 over I nabla plus small k squared plus u of r u k as a function of r times e in power I k r equal to e u k r e I k r. Then we just simply cancel the general prefactor e in power I k r here, here, and we are left with the equation that resembles the Schrödinger equation, only acting of on u k of r. And we know that u k of r is periodic with the period equal to large r. So we in fact have the equation that in which u k of r is the function with periodic boundary conditions only within the unit cell. And because it is limited by the unit cell, then eigenvalues and eigenfunctions must have some additional index. And we call it index n, band index. So the solutions of this equation will be classified with additional index n. So this is the equation for a particle in a unit cell. So you simply because u of k, what we have shown, is periodic. Is periodic. Equation for a particle in a unit cell. And hence eigenvalues and eigenfunctions will have additional index. And call it n. So that's why all our eigenvalues and eigenfunctions will be classified also as having not only k belonging to the first Brillouin zone, but also having additional index n. Well, the analogy here is pretty much simple. If you consider a particle in the box, then your eigenvalues are distinguished by some set of integer numbers. Here, the situation is completely simple. Instead of a large box, we have just the unit cell. So as a result, also all our eigenenergies E will be labeled as E with the index n and functions of quasi-momentum k, so k belonging to the first Brillouin zone. So they obey the property that En of k small plus any reciprocal lattice vector k large equal to En as a function of k small. And they completely determine the band structure of the spectrum of the particle moving in periodic potential. So Before finishing, I will make just last note, just a very simple note. K belonging to the first brilliant zone is quasi-momentum. And not to be confused with ordinary momentum. With ordinary momentum. Why? Because the eigen functions, this is because the eigenfunctions psi, k, n, functions of R are not the eigenfunctions. So these functions are not the eigenfunctions. Oh, sorry. Of momentum operator H over I nabla. This is just a simple exercise to check. So the fact that K belongs to the first brilliant zone does not make it the standard quantum mechanical momentum when, for example, we have free particle moving in a box. Albeit all the physics is determined by exactly this vector belonging to the first brilliant zone. And of course, band index. So that's all I wanted to tell you. I'm right on time. So if you just have any questions, just come and ask now. Thank you.